Brussels. This is September the 1st, 1978. This is tape number 350 from Carmel, California. Well, it's pretty good to be back after 2 weeks' vacation. I was up in Canada for 2 weeks. A lot of people thought I wasn't away. They were sure I was at the hearings in Washington or glued to the television set, that I couldn't possibly take off at the time James Earl Ray was testifying. But we did. I had promised my daughter and our niece and friend and we would take this vacation. It was a much-needed vacation, and I love to go camping, and we went for 2 weeks. At first, I was going to make a tape. I made a tape for you on the hazards of May Brussels traveling, an itemized list of all the things that have happened to me on various trips that are most unusual and some of them pretty scary, and it took just about one half of this tape, so I'm erasing it, and I'm just going to go right into the James Earl Ray testimony. Sometime, if you're interested in knowing about those hazards, I'll do a tape cassette for you on it. But I think right now the House Select Committee is more important than the impossible and dangerous hazards that happened to Mae Brussels and family on her trips. So we'll get right into those. While I was away, Betty Phillips of the Tape Center taped the entire set of the hearings. And if any of you want these tape cassettes, the Famous Voices Museum here in Pacific Grove, California, will duplicate them and has the sets for you. There are 7 sets, that's 14 hours of hearings, and they have edited out all the pauses and lapses so that these sets are available, and I believe the total is $55 or $350 for each cassette, plus 6% tax in California. From the time that the House Select Committee was formed in Washington, D.C., I knew it would be a total failure, and I've spoken about that many times on the various programs and on Dialogue Conspiracy. I take it back. I don't mean a total failure. I mean every time that Washington has an investigation of this type, it is excellent to have it televised and put into the congressional testimony, and also we will be able to purchase from the government printing office the House Select Committee's work on the assassination of Martin Luther King and John Kennedy, President John Kennedy. The wonderful good thing about this is that you can view how these cover-up artists work, and you get a better picture of the manipulation of both the media and the minds of the Americans and the collusion at the highest level of the Justice Department, the way they can spend millions of dollars and come to erroneous conclusions and outright errors and accept falsified evidence and witness perjury, and do a terrible job. If we had no investigation, you wouldn't be able to see how these people operate. There was no public investigation material made available on Robert Kennedy's assassination as there was in the John Kennedy assassination. But I maintained all along, if you studied that, as I did for 8 years before I even publicly went on the air or wrote one article, if you just study it extensively, you break down the formula of investigations whereby the highest officials appear to be doing something while they're not doing it at all. And it's a good guideline. Somebody who takes these tapes in Illinois wrote to me and said that even though he's acquired a great many of them, he was a little skeptical of what I said about the FBI and the CIA covering up until James Earl Ray was called before the House Select Committee. And as he watched the committee operate, he became more and more convinced that the things that I'm saying probably are true, and he's more in my camp now than he was before because he can see them operating. And that is the important thing. It was worth the $3 million to the taxpayers to just see these bastards operate. Now, the specifics of the case. I'm going to jump around. I came home and typed, made up for all my vacation by typing up over 150 pages of James Earl Ray's testimony and the questions, and I have them all before me, and I will jump around certain things that are important I will get to right away, and I won't be able to cover all, but we'll do the best we can. One of the first persons that was called to testify was a pathologist, Dr. Michael M. Baden, and he looked at the x-rays and autopsy reports of the murder of Martin Luther King, and he was very sure that he could not determine the path of the bullet that killed Martin Luther King. Well, he said it was possible or consistent, entirely consistent, that a shot could have come from the rooming house bathroom. He said he couldn't rule out the possibility that It also could have come from some other spot or a bushy area alongside of the rooming house. Harold Weisberg, in his book Frame-Up, talks about the fact that there was commotion outside the rooming house below the bathroom window. There's a vacant lot that he writes about that's covered with bushes 12 to 15 high, 15 feet high. And Dr. King's chauffeur by the name of Solomon Jones told reporters just a few minutes after the shooting, I'm reading from Harold Weisberg's book, that just after the shot was fired, a man with a sheet over his head ran out of the bushes heading south. Another witness, with a nickname of Cornbread Carter, said that he saw a man fire a shot from the bushes and then take off. And Weisberg noted that there's a concealed position in the firehouse where the police could be watching the area of Dr. Martin Luther King. You see, the implication that Ray bought binoculars and he was watching King still doesn't explain how in the world he would know that Martin Luther King was in that building. But the Memphis police were, in quotes, guarding him, and the FBI knew he was there. And they had a clear view of, in quotes, protecting him, similar to Thane Caesar, the security guard protecting Robert Kennedy in the Ambassador Hotel. And the firemen and the police heard the shot, and they all thought, according to this Cornbread Carter, there's a quotation, that it came from the bushes and not from the window 20 feet above. Now, you notice the House Select Committee hasn't sought these witnesses, Solomon Jones, the driver for Martin Luther King, his chauffeur. They haven't asked this Mr. Carter. They seem to be searching for witnesses that would confirm where James Earl Ray was at the time, even though he hasn't established where he was at the time. But they made no effort to call any policeman or fireman from those buildings where they could see Martin Luther King, and the committee, of course, didn't have any intention of calling these people that saw somebody with a sheet over his head running from the bushes at the time that Martin Luther King was killed. I had the distinct impression that James Earl Ray, listening to his voice, I didn't get the chance to see him on the TV, but listening carefully to the tapes and recounting his story, is still under some kind of a mind control. This has never been brought up, of course. The fact, one of the congressmen cited 55 incidences that were part of a statement that James Earl Ray agreed upon when he pleaded guilty, but they mentioned his taking a lock, he called it a lock-picking course. That was funny, he's going to be a lock-picker. They talked about his bartending and his dancing classes and his activities and his face surgery, but nobody mentioned that he had been to a hypnotist in Los Angeles, even though that came out a few years ago, that James Earl Ray had gone to a hypnotist in Los Angeles. And he also, when he was arrested in London, he had three books on hypnotism with him. And there is no suggestion in all of this, of course, of a chance that he could be under mind control. And yet there were things that he said that I may jump around with that indicated that that his mind was affected. Ray didn't show any antagonism towards Raul at all. He just accepted the fact that they were going to be part of a crime, that he would use a different name, a criminal act would take place. He called New Orleans to see what happened up there in Memphis. He doesn't ask the committee if they ever checked to see if the rifle that was taken from the rooming house with his prints on it was later checked to see if it even had been fired that day or fired at all. And he didn't ask them to check out why Raul would carry the bundles, or if the description that the people saw in the rooming house was even Raul, if the choice had to be either Ray or Raul, or if there was even a third person, a different man, if Raul didn't just direct him like George de Morenschel directed Lee Harvey Oswald, and a different person just ran from the rooming house. He's never curious about the fact that this could just be a planted thing. He doesn't bring this up at all, that it could be all swept up into this bedspread without fingerprints of another person for the purpose of making him a patsy. He suggests the deprivation, the treatment that he had affected his mind, but of course the subject of chemicals never comes up. Food or drugs or medical treatment, at first they give him the lights and solitary confinement, as he said, after 7 or 8 months it begins to work on you. He knows he wasn't there, but he doesn't know any more than that. And he was told, I'm sure, prior to the assassination of Martin Luther King, that something was going to happen, but he may get a small rap as a co-conspirator, he said. That was his impression. He'd be a co-conspirator but he would get 7 to 15 years gladly, and that would be it. And yet he doesn't mention who he mentions Raoul, but he has no anger towards him. He mentions calling him in New Orleans like he's calling a parent, like a father figure, a case officer, like George de Morinchild was to Lee Harvey Oswald. James Earl Ray said he called to see if a crime was committed, but he knew a crime was going to be committed. He had purchased a rifle on instructions, and he said that Raoul had assigned him. He used the word, I carefully typed up all of these cassettes. They're very valuable to type up. He said Raoul assigned rooms to him, and he was assigned to this rooming house. He went there, and he left a gun there. He left binoculars. He used a different name, John Willard, because he knew a crime was going to be committed, and he didn't want to use the regular name that the car was registered under, the Galt name. He knew the rifle wasn't for gun running. You know, you don't do big gun running by getting a single gun in Birmingham, Alabama, you know, with binoculars and putting it in a room. And he didn't wonder if somebody used his gun. I mean, that subject never came up. They never asked him, did you think anybody could have used the gun, you know, after you purchased it? There was no question by the committee towards James Earl Ray on that subject. And he said he got in his car and he fled, and he went to call New Orleans to see if a crime was committed. So evidently he wanted to know if his team was involved, because here's a former convict who's escaped, who has credible identification. He has the name Galt. He has a car registered in his name and the ID. He could have gone to the nearest gas station or restaurant and stayed in there while they investigated the assassination of Martin Luther King, and he would be seen and nobody would question him. The fleeing was what made people go after him, even though the evidence can't link him to the murder. He had to have instructions, just like Candy Jones would go to Taiwan. Candy Jones, in the book, The Control of Candy Jones, could get her memory erased. She had a double personality. She could be at the intelligence agency and have carrots put in her vagina and burns on her body and give demonstrations of holding up against pain or talking. And I'm sure that James Earl Ray might have been programmed to actually think that he was Galt. He knew that he was a partner in something, but the mind control is still evidence, and the demonstrations at the intelligence agency of Candy Jones are no different than the demonstration on national television of James Earl Ray. There is this naivete, the sharpness about certain things, and the lack of anger towards Galt, and consistent, you know, like I'll just serve 15 years as a co-conspirator, and not worried about the evidence planted against him. He says, I would plead guilty again under the circumstances, and it's obvious that he is taking some kind of instructions hypnotically that have kept him locked in accepting certain parts of the story consistent with what he was probably promised, that you will get another trial, that you will get a hearing, and so forth. And this placates him, and he is getting attention, and he is getting hearings, but he's just as muddled as he was 10 years ago. When James Earl Ray was explaining his escape from the Missouri jail, which I'll go into in a little while, that's important, he told how he stayed two or three nights by a train track and then went to a trailer that was open, that had wine and food. We never know whose trailer that was. Nobody testified or was ever called at any time. Certainly, he was told to plead guilty. He had no trial. But the House Select Committee, I am positive, has never located the owner of the trailer that conveniently had food or wine. Now, that could be an assist in his escape that nobody has even asked about, that he conveniently has this kind of assistance. And then he goes on to Kansas City, and then St. Louis. And he said in quotes on these tapes, I went to the residence of an individual called Mr. Gorn, a nickname of the Catman, and I intended for Mr. Dorn to arrange for his transportation to Edwardsville. And Dorn wasn't home. So he said, I just caught a taxi and went to East St. Louis. And the House Select Committee never, of course, would call Mr. Dorn as a witness and ask who he is, who is the Catman, and why did James Earl Ray assume that he was going to arrange transportation? You see, I had heard through some research or an article that the warden of the Missouri jail was an officer with the Bay of Pigs operation, an attorney, that he's a lawyer. And James Earl Ray is very carefully protecting. He says over and again, he's protecting the people who helped him escape from the Missouri penitentiary. Now, the escape is important because there was a cellmate with James Earl Ray by the name of Bridgman, and later he meets another Bridgman and has the alias of Bridgman, who's traveling to Florida. And this man is in the cell with James Earl Ray, and he hears that there's this large amount of money offered for killing Martin Luther King. And shortly after this man hears about it, a year later, this was in 67, by 1968, James Earl Ray was arrested, and he was surprised that his old cellmate was charged with a crime, because while he was in jail, there was talk about money being offered to kill Martin Luther King. Now, this is way beyond coincidence that this money is talked about in the Missouri jail, and then James Earl Ray is arrested a year and a half later. But the warden was never called and should be called. As I say, I think he's an attorney. He worked with the Bay of Pigs, which would mean with E. Howard Hunt and Frank Sturgis and Bernard Barker and the Watergate plumbers, the same people that were able to go to the CIA and get aliases and false names and documents for people. And the escape from the jail is primary because, first of all, as I say, the trailer that was available, and second, this Mr. Dorn, the committee just completely passes that over. They don't ask, who is he? They keep trying to pin all of the responsibility on James Earl Ray, Jerry Ray, and John Ray. They want to make it a family affair and not a conspiracy, and yet they don't go into the warden's story, and Ray intimates several times that he had help leaving the jail and that he didn't want to get anyone in trouble, therefore he wasn't going to expose this story. But he goes to Dorn, and Dorn isn't there, but why did he think that he was going to help him and arrange the transportation? Now, the day before James Earl Ray escaped, in quotes, escaped from Missouri, his brother, Jerry Ray, visited him. But his brother, it works for Mr. Stoner of the States' Rights Party, the man who is against blacks and Jews, a known racist who works with wealthy people who do not want labor unions and blacks incorporated into the power structure, the labor market, anywhere in the country, much less the South. And Jerry Ray is a known racist, and he might have had contacts or been a conduit, because the day that James Earl Ray escapes, he has the alias of Raines. And that's an interesting thing, because how many people have a Social Security card in their hands? He couldn't counterfeit this or photograph this in a jail or prison. Certainly in Missouri, he couldn't be doing this. And they must go through their documents and papers in the jail, and when families visit, things that are exchanged are usually noticed by guards, and yet Jerry Ray visited James Earl Ray and was never asked, and never will be asked, on a stand, and James Earl Ray was never asked, did your brother bring you false identification? I think there's more chance that Jerry Ray brought him the Raines card that could have been printed by the CIA way in advance than there was that Jerry Ray got involved in a bank robbery in Illinois. Well, this man that was supposed to arrange the transportation that wasn't home was contacted later, and James Earl Ray went back to the town, East St. Louis, and bought a Plymouth for $200, and then he called Jack, the cat man, and he purchased a pistol for him, he says from a fence, and he told Gorn, reach my family and tell them I'm leaving the country, and I will contact them later, and don't mention that you saw me. So he did make contact. An ex-con was able then to pick up a weapon. He had a false ID. He crosses to Canada, and he goes through from Detroit, Michigan, which is a nice place to go over. I have mentioned before on the tapes that the car of John Kennedy now rests in the basement of the Ford Motor Company in Detroit, Michigan, where it should be taken to Washington and examined for the investigation into the murder of John Kennedy. Detroit, Michigan, he may have met other people. Henry Ford has been described over and over in books as a conduit of tremendous anti-Semitism in this country. He printed the Prodigals of Elder Zion. He whipped up the mentality of people of Jerry Ray and Stoner in the South and fed them a lot of anti-Semitic literature and sent it all over the world. Henry Ford is mentioned. I was reading Facts and Fascism on my vacation by George Seldes, and he describes the Ford Motor Company and Charles Lindbergh and the Hearst organizations and their Nazi connections. The Ford Motor Company has been notorious and has even had a role, as I say, in the Kennedy assassination, keeping the car of John Kennedy there in their possession so it can't be examined, the metal frame from the inside, to see if there's still some marks of the bullets in that car. So, no, the question is never asked, did he see any person in Detroit, Michigan, where this Orloff, who was with Marina Oswald and George de Moranshield, and Orloff had been with Henry Ford, Tsaris from Russia had been with Henry Ford, the older one. But the Ford Foundation, incidentally, coincidentally, is funding the public broadcasting of the James Earl Ray interrogation of the House Select Committee. And I thought that was pretty funny that the Ford Foundation is doing this for KQED. But the question, of course, is never asked when he goes from Detroit to Michigan, if he saw anyone in Detroit. Did he really rob the whorehouse? Because there's no way of checking that out. They can't call the police and say, we were robbed, well, what's your business? We're prostitutes. So the $1,700 that he says he got from a whorehouse could have come from Detroit, Michigan, until he gets his papers and money from Raoul to begin his traveling. But James Earl Ray has never asked about contacts in Detroit, which would be a logical place to pick up him some more money after he has a car and a gun, and he's been in Illinois. As I say, this one person is never called, the warden's never called, Mr. Dorn is never called, and these are important witnesses that we'll never hear from by the House Select Committee. James Earl Ray was describing on the first cassette, tape one, side two, that he went to Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, and then he came back from Mexico into the United States, but from Tijuana in the United States. And when they searched his Mustang, when he came across the border, there was a business card in his Mustang that said New Orleans, L-E-A-A, and it had the name of a Randolph Irwin Rosen, R-O-S-E-N. And Playboy magazine, in an effort to discredit James Earl Ray, came out with an article in 1977, September 77, which he was furious about at the time and was going to sue them. But he was very mild on TV. This is why I think there was some kind of control. When they brought up the subject of the Playboy article, there was no anger or emotion in James Earl Ray about the way he's been framed. He's very calm about it. And he said that the Playboy article looked into the inconsistencies of what he said, and that there was no LEAA, the law enforcement agency. It was formed after the murder of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy until 1968. But he said there was an OEAA, the forerunner of that, and there was an office in New Orleans. But then he says something very interesting for those of you that have tape recorded or want a copy of this. He said, upon request, this is James Earl Ray saying it, direct quote, upon request, the late Clyde Watts, an attorney in Oklahoma, investigated in 1964, reported thereafter that Randolph Irvin Rosen was, in fact, Randolph Irvin Rosen's son. Now, some of you may wonder what in the heck that is about, because later, one of the men said, why did you bring this up about Rosenson? And the committee, everyone left it blank. Mark Lane, the attorney for James Earl Ray, everyone left this space blank. And the name probably would skip you if you didn't know who Clyde Watts is. Now, in the first place, James Earl Ray described him as the late Clyde Watts. That's two of the major witnesses of this case that are dead. The other one is Wilson, the person who might have identified James Earl Ray at the gas station that Mark Lane said he saw in a hospital and interviewed and tape recorded. But then after that, after Mark's visit, Wilson had died. Well, I have to check the date now on Clyde Watts' death. He referred to him as an Oklahoma attorney. But I don't know why he says that in 1964... he investigated Rosen, because I wonder if James Earl Ray or Jerry Ray knew Clyde Watts in 1964. That's the year that he was very much involved in the John Kennedy assassination. Clyde Watts is the attorney, was the attorney for Major General Edwin Walker. And in 1964, he was called as an attorney for Walker to represent Walker before the Warren Commission. There were 552 witnesses before the Warren Commission, and only one man had an attorney with him, I believe, and that was Walker, General Walker, and the attorney was Clyde Watts, and that was happening in 64. And I wonder, the links of General Walker to the assassination of John Kennedy are enough. I'll do a whole tape for you sometime on that. But James Earl Ray used the date 1964, and Martin Luther King wasn't killed until 1968. Ray was still in the penitentiary, and he used the name Randolph Irvin Rosenson. In volume 11 of the Warren Commission hearings, there's the testimony of Major General Edwin Walker. It's on page 404 it begins. And as I say, I can do a whole program for you on it because it's very, very important to refresh your memory on the links of General Walker and the Texas races, the connections to the Southwest. But pages 404 to 434 of the Warren Commission hearings has General Walker, Major General Edwin Walker, as a witness before the Warren Commission with this Clyde Watts, who James Earl Ray is referring to. And I don't know where James Earl Ray got his name. And I think this is important because of Jerry Ray and Stoner connections to General Walker, why James Earl Ray brought it up at this time. And I got out my volume of commission hearings, page volume 26, page 474 and 475. And there's an affidavit signed by a William McEwen Duff, D-U-F-F, and a message was given May 26, 1964, and James Earl Ray is referring to that year, 64, from Secret Service agent, a special agent, James R. Cantrell, from the U.S. Treasury Department in Oklahoma City. And he's there because a certain man, William McEwen Duff, is in the custody of Clyde Watts. And the Secret Service report said that Mr. Duff claimed that there was an association between Jack Ruby, who had earlier killed Lee Harvey Oswald, and General Edwin A. Walker from Dallas, Texas, and that during that period of December 1962 through March of 63, while Duff was employed by General Walker, he resided in his home. Jack Ruby visited the home of General Walker once a month. Each time he was in the company of two unidentified white males. He arrived in a Ford car. Duff claimed the identification of Ruby through photographs. He heard him addressed only as Jack, and he described the other two males that were at the home of General Walker. Duff advised that the three had always convened with Walker in the living room of the Walker residence. Duff couldn't hear their conversations, at no time overheard them, but saw the man, Ruby, and knew him by the name of Jack. Duff fled, and he went to Oklahoma. He said he felt he knew too much about General Walker's operation and of the persons visiting his residence, intimating that Walker was diverting funds collected from the John Birch Society to a personal account at the Highland Park Bank in Dallas, Texas. Duff had called Secret Service agent Cantrell on long-distance telephone from Lawton, Oklahoma, in May of 64 to advise that the man who offered him $10,000 if he would kill General Walker had been following him at Lawton. Remember, there was an attempt to shoot General Walker and then later blame it on Lee Harvey Oswald. Secret Service agent Cantrell said that in May 64, he received a long-distance telephone call from Mrs. Duff in which she said her husband had vital information in the case concerning the assassination of John Kennedy. Duff insisted that he had the truth, and he volunteered to tell them what he knew. Later, he got employment in Oklahoma City through General Clyde Watts, whom he described as an attorney in Oklahoma City and counsel for General Edwin Walker from Dallas, Texas. Mrs. Duff was reminded that by Duff that he was to contact James Cantrell of the Secret Service and give his information, but later he called his wife when he was in the custody of Clyde Watts in Oklahoma, the attorney, and he said, "You notify Secret Service agent Cantrell that I'll be done, that I cannot be called a witness, that I'll be killed," and we never heard any more about Mr. Duff, whether he's alive or dead. I'll have to check with Penn Jones and see if he heard any more. But he claims that he knew a lot about General Walker and Clyde Watts, and then he went to work for Watts. He hired him in Oklahoma City, this person that used to work for Walker in Texas. General Watts found employment for me as a heavy equipment operator in road construction, Oklahoma City, by reason of his former association with General Walker. I say volume 26, I'll give you the page numbers on the bibliography, describes Mr. Duff and his relationship to Clyde Watts and General Walker.